CBD will reduce cravings, whether it's for cigarettes, whether it's for heroin or cocaine. THC has impacts on the endogenous opioid system to get the body to release its own opioids, which will help with withdrawal. So there's a lot of benefits for using cannabis and THC to treat opioid addiction.
This is the Cannabis Enigma, cutting through the smoke to have informed, serious conversations for regular people. Hi, I'm Michael Schaefer Ummerman.
And I'm Alana Goldberg. Who do we have on the show today, Mike?
So I spoke with Dr. Joseph Morgan, who's a physician and a cannabis researcher who's been working in the field for, well, a long time. And we spoke about everything from the role of cannabis in addiction treatment to the problems that federal law in the U.S. poses to medical cannabis research and a workaround that he thinks he's found to that. And everything from, you know, how patients can better choose their cannabis to women's health issues and why cannabis is pretty well suited to treat everything from menstrual cramps to endometriosis. And actually, one of the really fascinating things that came out of that discussion was he explained why something that we often think of as a negative side effect of cannabis, which is short-term memory loss, can actually be really useful for chronic pain patients when it helps them forget their pain.
Super interesting. Well, I'm keen to hear the interview because I actually haven't had a chance to listen yet. And so we'll get straight to that. But remember that after the episode, we have our regular segment from our partners at Americans for Safe Access. This week, the segment looks into medical cannabis in schools and the various issues and hoops that parents and children with medical cannabis prescriptions need to jump through in order to be able to use their prescription medication in the education system.
Let's get to it.
All right. Here's the episode.
Dr. Joseph Morgan, thank you so much for being with us today. So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into cannabis medicine?
I would say I got into it as a awkward teenager who found my anxiety relieved, and I could really appreciate music, and I would go to live concerts and as well as relax with cannabis. And it's something that I never forgot, even though I walked away from it for many, many years when it became career ending if you were busted, especially as going through medicine. Always fascinated with psychoactive drugs, including in medical school, a lot of interest in psychiatry. And I ended up practicing drug and alcohol rehab medicine. And I kind of noticed that cannabis was never really a serious issue for people compared to the hard drugs and alcohol that brought them in for inpatient treatment. In fact, we wouldn't even admit patients who were just heavy cannabis users or addicted to cannabis. Make a long story short, I was interested in drugs for protection from chemical war nerve agents, and I couldn't get the medicines that I wanted. So I came to Israel about 15 years ago, and people were asking me for medical cannabis consults, and I said, I don't really know a whole lot about it. Let me research it, and I'll get back to you. So as I researched cannabis, it became clear to me that the pharmacological properties of the plant were very beneficial against the toxic properties of chemical war nerve agents, like VX, sarin, cyclosarin, tabloin, so-called nerve gases, the ones that have been used by many people in the Middle East to murder people, as well as by a cult in Tokyo. I contacted Rafi Meshulam with some of my very specific ideas, which would include cannabinoids are useful against seizures, nerve agents induce seizures, nerve gases cause bronchospasm and cause the lungs to fill with fluid. Cannabis causes dry mouth, which is unwanted in a recreational user, but dry mouth and dry eyes and drier lungs would be very much, very beneficial in the setting of chemical war nerve agents. And there are many other properties. I eventually put this theme together as God's plant versus man's toxins. So that's how I got into cannabis. I have a patent issued in Israel and pending in the U.S. and Canada and in the EU for cannabis against chemical war nerve agents. And along the way, I figured out how to make cannabis legal, taking it outside of Schedule One in the United States, and how to study the entourage effects. I presented this at the International Cannabinoid Research Society several years ago, and I was surprised that regulators around the world thought I had a great workaround the illegal nature of cannabis. And I got a lot of compliments from Israeli scientists who I presented my work to in private, you know, including Lumir Hanush, who thought I had come up with a really important way to study the endocannabinoid system and entourage effects. And I'll be happy to share that with you in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, sure. So what does it mean to make it legal to take it out of the Schedule One category?
Okay, well, cannabis has a lot of interesting components. Delta-9 THC, the main psychoactive component, is actually legal if it is synthetic under the name dronabinol and if it comes in capsules that are diluted in sesame oil. It's in Schedule 3 with a brand name Marinol in the United States, and it's also available as a liquid in Schedule 2. Dronabinol is also in Schedule 1 if it's outside of those formulations. So for my THC, I began with Marinol capsules, dronabinol capsules, and extracted the THC inside of with the sesame oil, cooling it 9.5 milligrams per 10 milligram capsule, allowing for loss. There's also a much more potent THC-like drug available in the United States and many other countries. The generic name is Nabilone. The brand name in the U.S. is Sesamet. So that could be another source of THC. Now, for cannabidiol, I had several options. One is hemp extract. And in my research, I specified in the protocol the only allowable contaminant of the hemp extract is up to 99% CBD or CBG or CBC. So I was able to find a source of 99.9% CBD, a powder that was a hemp extract. So that was my hemp extract, not scheduled. Today, I could use Epidiolex, which is GW Pharmaceuticals, FDA-approved CBD. And I also used some other sources of CBD in my earlier experiments with rats to get patent. Now, for the terpenes, I used a combination of synthetic terpenes that were made by Sigma Aldrich Fine Chemical that were also kosher certified and were food grade. These have FDA or Food and Drug Administration status as generally recognized as safe. And I used one terpene, limonene, was derived from citrus peels, and that was 99%. So that was a natural terpene. Now, in my patent that's already been issued, I have combinations of 5 to 7 terpenes, which would include pinene, limonene, beta-caryophyllene, linalool, terpenolene, and myrcene, of course. And all of these are in ratios that are both found and not found in nature. Same thing with the cannabinoids, CBD and THC, ratios found and not found in nature. And same thing with the terpenes. And I did some very specific ratios in my rat studies. So that's how I, if I can use the word, found a legal way of taking the major medicinal chemicals in the cannabis plant and sourcing them from non-illegal methods or sources, or in other words, sourcing each of them completely legally, and all of the terpenes were assayed. And then I sent out my mixtures to a lab called the Workshop on the West Coast, and they were able to confirm that the mixtures of cannabinoids and terpenes that I had made and administered to rats did in fact match what was assayed. So for example, if one of my terpenes was assayed at 80%, there were some minor terpenes that also showed up, and these were some of the other 20% in that particular synthetic terpene. So that's, in summary, legally sourcing THC and CBD and legally sourcing terpenes, checking on the assays of them, and then putting them together in ratios found and not found in nature and administering them to rats in a toxicology study. And then I did one other thing. I also had it prescribed to me as compound pharmacy, starting with dronabinol. The pharmacist wanted to see all the certificates of analysis, and I gave him the original stock bottles from the Sigma Aldrich Fine Chemicals, and he said he would be able to do that. And so I have basically legal cannabis mimic prescribed to me as a liquid. So that's some of my background work on how to make cannabis legal.
It's such a almost bizarre metaphor for the laws and everything surrounding cannabis, that you can reconstruct it and it's legal, but a plant that is natural and, you know, abundant around the world is illegal.
Yes! And that's one of the enigmas of it. And that's why regulators said to me at the International Cannabinoid Society, great workaround. So part of it is in my research and in my scientific presentations, I talk about how cannabis is regulated like heroin, but I figured out a way how to basically recreate its medicinal components in DEA Schedule 3. And I had legal review, institutional review board review, and they came up with, yes, the most restricted chemical is dronabinol in Schedule 3, and it's FDA approved. So we'll do the rat studies in the toxicology lab as Schedule 3 studies, not Schedule 1.
It actually reminds me a little bit of how heroin is illegal, and yet oxycodone is, you know, passed out far too commonly from a, you know, synthetic or pharmaceutically constructed standpoint. I want to actually go there. You know, prior to COVID, the opioid epidemic was one of the biggest public health crises in the United States. And we hear more and more people talking about cannabis as something that could help fight that. You mentioned that you worked in addictive medicine or addiction medicine. You know, the law treats them the same. As somebody specializing in working with people in recovery and addicts, what's your thoughts when you see those two, you know, heroin and or opioids and cannabis in the same category or treated the same way legally?
Well, I often pointed out they're both in Schedule 1, yet opioids in the United States kill about 75,000 people a year, and cannabis kills zero. It doesn't make any sense from a scientific toxicological viewpoint. In fact, I actually wrote a book chapter called Cannabis, a Biospiritual Remedy for Addiction, in which, and it's chapter 16 in the textbook Cannabis is Medicine. So in the chapter that I wrote on cannabis and addiction, I go through the history where in the 1890s, the medical literature described weaning opioid and cocaine addicts off of those drugs with tinctures of cannabis. Same is also true for alcoholics. So this is described in one case in 13 doses of a tincture of cannabis were sufficient to wean an American Navy surgeon who had been injecting morphine twice a day for quite a while. So the use of cannabis to treat addiction is not something new. In those days, there weren't really great assays for what were the medical components. But my basic protocol, and what I write about in the chapter, is CBD will reduce cravings, whether it's for cigarettes, whether it's for heroin, or cocaine. THC has impacts on the endogenous opioid system to get the body to release its own opioids like endorphins and enkephalins, which will help with withdrawal. The cannabinoid receptor and the mu opioid receptor co-localize, meaning that they're next to each other. Activation of one activates the other. So there's a lot of benefits for using cannabis and THC to treat opioid addiction. Several studies have shown that heroin addicts who have access to cannabis and who use cannabis inject less often in a statistically significant way. Some of the research was published in Canada, other in the United States, and some rat work was done actually in Greece. So cannabis can be used to wean, and it can also help with cravings. And then I want to go on a little bit deeper. There's very specific genetics of addiction. And that genetics of addiction was worked out by Dr. Kenneth Blum, who's also my co-author in the book chapter. He's identified 22 genes that are involved in addiction. And these genes have impacts in the brain reward cascade. So basically, addicts just don't feel right. They don't have enough dopamine in the brain reward cascade. And the substances that they use, whether they're cocaine, heroin, food, stimulate dopamine release and help them feel right. Ultimately, they downregulate their systems and have a lot of toxic impacts from their substance and feel worse and worse. But at least in the short term, they release dopamine and helps them feel good. Well, cannabis can do some of the same thing. And of course, with far less harm. So then it becomes a question of harm reduction. So in general, my protocol for opioid addiction is conventional drugs can be used, but in addition, CBD should be available as much as a person wants. Same thing with cannabis containing THC. Ultimately, they should go from more THC to a mixture of THC and CBD, and then ideally to mostly CBD, unless there are specific medical indications for THC. So, for example, insomnia, lack of sleep, or pain would be medical indications for the THC in cannabis. And in addition to cannabis, Other things that give us pleasure would include sex, music, hugging, yoga, exercise, really good nutrition. So those are some of the things in the protocol that are in the chapter, Cannabis, a Biospiritual Remedy for Addiction.
In a few states, including Pennsylvania, where you work, there's a requirement that pharmacists be in medical cannabis dispensaries. And you actually teach pharmacists about medical cannabis. What do you think the benefit of involving a medical professional like a pharmacist at that level is? And is that something we should sort of aspire to apply more across the board, across the country, across the world?
That's a great question. And it doesn't have a simple answer. So I'd like to address the nuances. If you have a young, healthy person, or even an older, healthy person who wants to use small amounts of cannabis for anxiety, for sex enhancement, for insomnia, or for pain, and they're not on other medications, and they don't have issues with other substances, and they don't have other systemic diseases or very mild diseases like seasonal allergies, they don't need a pharmacist. However, Pennsylvania has a medical program with serious medical conditions, and many of the medical patients are over the age of 60, have complex medical problems, and are on multiple medications. And in that setting, I think a pharmacist can be very helpful to look for drug-drug interactions and to help recommend doses and types of cannabis. And by types, I don't mean specific strains. That's actually illegal under federal law, but rather ratios of cannabinoids, different types of cannabis. So for example, a person with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or with asthma should not be getting flower to smoke from a medical dispensary. They've already got lung disease. Somebody, obviously a pharmacist and even a bud tender should know, for this person, recommend tinctures, drops under the tongue, something transdermal, anything other than smoking suppositories, a buccal patch that you put in the mouth, anything other than smoking. Also to watch on the doses. Now, there can be drug-drug interactions with cannabis, and this is particularly an area where a pharmacist could be very helpful so as to prevent patients from getting too dizzy, having problems with their heart rhythm, having blood pressure elevations, having blood pressure declines, having impairments, and potentially falling. So I do think that there's a role for a pharmacist in medical dispensaries, particularly with complex and more fragile patients. I think that it's a good idea that all dispensaries have a pharmacist available, and I think it would be very ethical that bud tenders be trained if they see a fragile patient and how to screen for a fragile patient, they refer that person, that customer, to a pharmacist or physician or somebody else who's very health knowledgeable to help them make the safest and the wisest choice.
How can people best choose the type of cannabis to use? You know, the main paradigm or framework that we see out there these days is Indica sativa. And I had Dr. Ethan Russo on in the last episode, and we talked a little bit about how that's kind of a false, you know, it doesn't mean anything these days. And we know that terpenes and other minor cannabinoids can have a great effect on the, you know, both the experiential and medicinal effects that cannabis can have. But there's very few tools out there that actually allow somebody to make an informed decision about that. How much information actually is there? You know, even if it was accessible, that people could make those kind of choices in a smart and informed way that would help them.
Well, Ethan Russo is, in my opinion, one of the greatest cannabis physicians in the world. And he wrote he's written so much, but one of the articles that I go back to again and again was on entourage effects that he published in a British Journal of Pharmacology in February 2011. And he talks about the different terpenes and the different cannabinoids and how they interact with each other. So I think that there's a lot of literature already out there that certain types of cannabis are more elevating, certain are more sedating. So I agree the terms indica and sativa hybrid, they don't mean much anymore. I'm sure Ethan covered this in great detail. Does it just refer to the shape of the leaf, the effect? So I like describing cannabis by its properties as well as by what the person is seeking. So are you looking for sedation to go to sleep? Then you want CBN and THC and myrcene and linalool. Are you looking for stimulation? Then you want CBD, a little THC, limonene, terpenoline. And you'll find what works for you by using other terpenes. So one of the things that I do is I offer people who consult with me what terpenes that they should add, how to get terpenes out of food. A lot of cannabis is ultimately individual, and a lot of cannabis should be done by ratio of THC, CBD. I did a clinical cannabis fellowship on the West Coast, and I learned basic ratio medicine, THC to CBD ratio, and I always personalize it based on several factors. One is, what are the indications that a person is looking for help with? Second, what is their familiarity with cannabis? Third, what is their desire for or against psychoactive effect? If they don't want to get high, then we're going to minimize or cut out the THC. If they don't mind getting high, then we can include THC, but customize some of the other cannabinoids and terpenes as well as their doses. So that's how I learned to practice cannabis medicine on the West Coast.
You mentioned sort of designing cannabinoid and terpene treatment. You're going to be speaking at the CanX conference, and well, it's online, in a few weeks. I think giving a talk on patenting cannabis medicines and products. I wanted to ask you, how does intellectual property in the medical realm differ, or how is it similar to other pharmaceutical products and research, particularly considering the regulatory and legal restrictions?
That's a great question. There's so many aspects of your question, Michael. Synthetic THC is legal. A novel chemical like nabilone is legal and patentable. The plant itself, you can't patent the plant. Now, GW Pharma does have patents on its plant because they have brilliant patent lawyers and found a way to also patent their compositions. I may be wrong, and I'm not a patent lawyer. And I want to apologize and say I might be wrong right now. I claim to have no expertise on GW's patents. But my patent came because my brilliant patent lawyer stressed ratios found and not found in nature and putting together something that doesn't exist in nature. synthetic terpenes don't exist in nature. So using the building blocks, I was able to get the patent. And then I also did one other thing for a patent. I made a molecule that combined THC with atropine, and I made another molecule that combined CBD with atropine in a single molecule, and that was a completely novel, those are completely novel chemical compounds. So I hope I answered your question, and I'm going to answer one other way. 600 discussions, novel discussions have been had with the FDA about making plant-based medicines. Two have resulted in approved drugs. 598 didn't get there. The FDA has made it almost impossible to have botanical approved medicine. And I'm going to go over some of the patent methods with the details at the CanX conference on October 26th, the CAN10 conference.
Is that process or the approach that you took something that has existed in other pharmaceutical research where, you know, either medicinal properties or chemical elements were found in plants, but then isolated and created synthetically?
Yes, and that's a very different thing, because historically medicines were botanical. The word drug comes from the Dutch word for dried herb or drought. So historically, one of the first drugs in the United States came from coal tar, the first pain reliever, coal tar, the dregs of petroleum. I don't know if it's a natural source, naturally occurring. And then acetanilid, which was a pain reliever and anti-inflammatory in the 1800s, was the first drug. So historically, a lot of drugs were found because pharmaceutical companies moved from isolating plants and drying herbs to single active pharmaceutical ingredients or APIs. So modern pharmaceutical industry is single API, single active pharmaceutical ingredient. There are a couple of maybe several common drugs that have two active pharmaceutical ingredients. So modern FDA approved medicines have moved to single APIs. Herbal medicine, including cannabis, has hundreds of APIs, active pharmaceutical ingredients. So to get it FDA approved, you have to do some level of toxicology and safety studies on each of the chemical constituents.
I know that part of your medical training came in gynecology. And one of the most exciting fields of cannabis research, some of which is being done by Lumir Hanush here in Jerusalem, is on cannabis as a treatment for endometriosis. I was wondering if you know anything about why this might be, you know, one of the few things that could work there and where the research stands. But also we hear anecdotally from women who use cannabis to treat menstrual pain and other symptoms. And that's, you know, something that it's, you know, been used for centuries, we know. Women's healthcare is oftentimes not talked about enough or as much as a lot of other issues. I guess I just want to hear your thoughts.
Well, thank you. I haven't looked at this in any depth, but I'll give you my general impressions. Endometriosis is a very painful condition, and cannabis helps with pain, period. Menstrual cramps are spasms of the uterus, and cannabis helps with muscle spasm. It helps relax muscle spasm. So that works right there. Endometriosis has some aspects of a cancer, not in the malignant sense, but in the sense tissue goes to where it shouldn't be going, like the lining of the endometrium goes to other places in the female pelvis. And it's activated during the menstrual cycle. So just as cannabis has some anti-tumor activities, it's possible that those same general anti-tumor properties may impact the endometrial deposits. Now, I'm just going to speculate because of my ignorance now. So all of these are possible. But there also may be issues with aberrant cannabinoid receptors or abnormalities in the very localized endocannabinoid system that cannabis or its constituents are helping to regulate in endometriosis. And also endometriosis, the pain is associated with some stigma, with some anxiety, with some embarrassment, with some social isolation from painful cramps. So cannabis can help with that anxiety. It could also help with some of the sleep issues. Endometriosis is associated with painful sexual intercourse called dyspareunia, and cannabis can help with painful sexual intercourse. It could also help with forgetting. The short-term memory loss is a negative property when you're having a conversation. You forget what you're talking about. But when it helps you to forget about pain, forget about thinking about pain, and especially in the setting of endometriosis, it's a very positive property. But for all of these reasons, without having researched it directly myself, that's how I could see it working.
Well, that's fascinating, especially the short-term memory loss being an asset, you know, whereas it's usually looked at as a negative side effect. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about how my work impacts entourage effects, because Lumir Hanush thought this was one of the most interesting aspects of my work. Rafi Meshulam, in the early 1960s, as many people know, isolated THC and gave 10 milligrams of pure THC to people in a piece of cake in his living room. But what I've done is figured out, just based on my methods, take dronabinol, take one terpene, look at its impact versus dronabinol. I actually vaped dronabinol that was prescribed to me, Marinol prescribed to me. I vaped it in a temperature-sensitive vaporizer, and then I added one terpene at a time based on the boiling point of that terpene to study the impact of dronabinol plus one terpene at a time of my seven terpenes. And then I did two. And then I did three. And based on the effects that it had on me, how much does it dry my mouth, and some other properties that I talked about with medical patients, that's how I figured out some formulas to study in the lab with rats against chemical war nerve agents. So, for example, I found that dronabinol could get me high, but then when I vaped myrcene or even smelled myrcene, it immediately changed it from a head high to a much more cerebrally functional body relaxation. So I found that with dronabinol, myrcene vaped or smelled helped change from too much psychoactivity. Now, I wouldn't say from too much, but helped bring down the level of psychoactivity or stonedness to more of a body relaxation. So using my methods, the constituents of cannabis, say cannabinoids, could be studied with each other or with one terpene at a time. And people can certainly use terpenes that are isolated from cannabis if they want or from plants if they want. But this is a way of more scientifically studying the entourage effects and seeing if there can be, if you will, a commonality of findings of entourage effects versus very individual effects. And I don't think it's going to be an all or one. I think that we will be able to make generalizations as more and more of this is studied along the methods that I have outlined.
Dr. Morgan, I have so many more questions, but we're out of time. So I think we'll just have to say that I have to have you back on.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to our next session.
My name is Andrew. I'm the policy coordinator at Americans for Safe Access. ASA is a nonprofit advocacy group for medical cannabis patients. Our goal is to ensure that every state has sensible cannabis policy for patients that protects their rights to fair and equal access to medicine. Ultimately, this means we think patients who medicate with cannabis should get the same treatment as patients who medicate with Adderall. Not coincidentally, because I wrote this with a theme in mind, that gulf in equity between an Adderall patient and a cannabis patient is one area which I think highlights just how far away we are from equity for patients. The CDC reports almost 8 million children between the ages of 2 and 17 have been diagnosed with ADHD in the United States. The survey estimates that some 62% of cases, almost two-thirds of these children, are taking some form of ADHD medication, whether it be Adderall, Vyvanse, or one of the numerous other prescription stimulants on the market. This means that roughly 5 million students are expected to go to school every day on stimulants college students take to stay wired for an all-nighter. I was one of these kids. At 15, I was prescribed Vyvanse. It didn't go well for me. I couldn't eat and wound up losing weight as an already skinny kid. And the slow-release tablet kept me amped well past what would have been my appropriate bedtime. This was in 2011, when the U.S. had reached its peak of pediatric ADHD diagnoses, 6.4% of children, the result of a decades-long upward trend. Prescriptions and the use of these stimulants have been normative for at least as long as I've been alive. In the same study, CDC reports that 9 of 10 ADHD diagnosed students had received some form of accommodation from the school district. American schools are clearly capable of forming cohesive education plans when students demonstrate a need for specialized care. With some form of medical cannabis legal in 48 states, children with conditions from seizures to cancer can now receive treatment that helps them live a normal day. There are thousands of children across the country registered as cannabis patients. No doctor is prescribing cannabis, a substance which is still stigmatized, lightly. These are children with severe illnesses who would not be able to pursue an education alongside their peers without this medicine. Despite this reality, only 11 states, California, Colorado, Delaware, the District of Columbia, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Washington currently have laws on the books that allow some way for medical cannabis dosing on school grounds. Parents of pediatric patients have to go out of their way to continue their child's treatment. If they're not in one of the 11 states I mentioned, that means picking their child up, leaving school grounds, dosing them, and returning them to school every day, maybe more than once a day. This is a massive inconvenience for parents. Now, there are a lot of questions this reality brings to mind. What kind of schedule can you maintain as a parent like this? How does it impact a child's education or their social life? But the most important to solving this issue may just be, why are school grounds, specifically, such a big part of this problem?
The root of this issue dates back to an evolution in drug policy and narcotics policing during the Nixon administration. The Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act, signed in 1970, most notably included the Controlled Substances Act, which pulled together and updated numerous narcotics policies to shape the rigid and stratified system of drug classification we use to this day. With this legislation, cannabis was given a Schedule I classification. In their words, marijuana has a high potential for abuse or no currently accepted medical use, which put it at the top of the new federal narcotics regime's priority list. Also included in this bill was the first drug-free school zone law. In the wake of the Nixon administration's reforms, drug-free school zones began to spring up all across the country in the 1970s. These zones were framed as precautions to keep harmful narcotics away from children by implementing increased penalties for drug possession within the defined range, usually 1,000 feet, of schools. In reality, police across the country use drug-free school zones to entrap drug users, resulting in harsher sentences. Schools act as community centers in rural, suburban, and urban geographies alike across the United States. Whole neighborhoods fall within school zones. In Tennessee, for example, drug-free school zones account for roughly 5.5% of the state's total land area. Even as states have legalized cannabis, their efforts to carve out consensus cannabis policy have unilaterally protected these school zone laws. NIMBY parents concerned that legalization may lead to their child's drug addiction were assured that their schools and their children would be safe from the horrible menace. That's why we often see zoning laws preventing dispensaries within 1,000 feet of a school included in legalization legislation. The states which have created exceptions to school zone policies have not all crafted policy to the same effect. All of them still have a way to go before there is equity amongst patients. Only California, Colorado, DC, and Virginia actually allow school staff to administer treatment, while the others require treatment to be administered by a caregiver, typically by the parent. Every law allowing for care on school grounds features language that allows individual schools or districts to opt out of allowing pediatric treatment if they feel under threat of losing federal funding. Things are far from perfect. We've got a long fight ahead of us before we get equity between patients. If you want to help, you can go to our website and make a donation at safeaccess.org/donate.
I'm Michael Schaefer-Ummerman. This episode was produced by Matan Whale and myself, edited and mixed by myself. The Cannabis Enigma is a co-production of The Conigma and Americans for Safe Access.